Up next from Supernova 2005, a presentation by John Seely Brown from IT Conversations. Hello, this is Doug Kay, the executive producer of IT Conversations. And today I'm excited to bring you another presentation from Supernova 2005, held in San Francisco, California, June 20th to 22nd, 2005. IT Conversations is underwritten by listener donations. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. And now, here's our presentation from Supernova 2005.
When I think about trying to understand business ecosystems, decentralization around business, two of the people who I think have for many years done some of the most groundbreaking work are John Hagel and John Seely Brown. They have a new book out that's looking at this question about how businesses collaborate and also looking at the real meaning of outsourcing, what it really means to operate in this globalized world. Ladies and gentlemen, John Seely Brown.
What we want to do in the next few minutes is talk a little bit about innovation ecologies that we've been studying in Asia in order to perhaps put a new spin on one way to look at what offshoring is all about and to try to change the discourse model in this country, but also to see how we can really take advantage of it here and elsewhere. It's very curious to me, in the last 2 days, including the workshop, we had a lot of interesting conversations about such things as path dependencies, swarms, long-tail distributions, network externalities, increasing returns. It's going to be interesting to see how these same ideas may play out exactly when it comes to looking at how real ecosystems themselves work with and without technology. What I wanted to talk about very briefly is this notion of these innovation networks and how they're shaping kind of global commerce. I want to first go through four quite different stories of disruptive process innovations we've been studying in Asia, having to do with or underlying, in fact, what we drive, what we buy, almost everything we buy, and what we wear. Then I want to talk about how that leads to acceleration of capability building, and then how there's a kind of an enabling set of confluences happening in IT architectures that accelerate this, and then the strategic ramifications that we see coming together from all these things brought together. And our real goal is to claim we're at a transition point where Ronald Coase's notion of the firm really now has to be replaced by something else. So that's what we're going to try to do in 20 minutes or so. I'm going to start, because I love cars, and you'll see in a moment motorcycles as well, looking at Toyota. This, of course, is basically more out of Japan than China and India. But Toyota has come in the news a great deal lately. And I want to kind of call our attention to the fact that Toyota has found a very interesting way to tap the creativity of thousands of their suppliers and their own employees in terms of creating new ideas, new innovations through the notion of productive friction. It's very interesting to look at how Toyota works with suppliers. Believe it or not, Toyota never picks a supplier based on price. They pick suppliers based on cost, not price. Price can be made up, and basically once you sign a deal, basically you always find that those prices don't hold up. Cost is something else. Interesting question. How does Toyota know the cost of what does it take for a particular supplier to make something? They understand the cost structure because they are the world's experts. And I have walked through factories with Toyota people, and they can simply walk through a supplier's factory, and they can nail with incredible precision the cost that that supplier actually has. Costs are always held in private. But if you see how these guys can understand the waste structures that's going on inside a particular factory, they can guess with amazing accuracy what the cost actually is. The second thing they do is they build basically long-term relationships with these suppliers, and they expect the suppliers to actually push back on them. That is to say, they say, here's what we kind of want, or maybe here's what we exactly want. And suppliers, both first, second, and third tier suppliers, are allowed to come back and say, well, you know, if you thought about doing it this way, we could actually do it a hell of a lot cheaper. And they can actually constantly, through this productive friction, actually construct new ways to build parts, change the design of the automobile or subassemblies, and so on and so forth. So it's very interesting to see the ongoing network of conversations and productive friction that is really happening. This is not too surprising if you actually look inside a Toyota factory, where basically the first moment anything goes wrong in a factory, that in factory is brought to a complete standstill. $5 billion capital expense can be frozen. And why do they freeze it at that exact moment? When something has been detected, any employee on that assembly line can freeze it, because they're freezing the context. That context, all the way propagating back in some cases to the supplier because of the lean manufacturing scheme, lets them do instantaneous problem solving because they have all the information there. Every problem becomes basically a single fault problem at that point. In fact, Tara is going to be talking a little bit later, but what's happening here is these are very interesting action points around which instantaneous problem solving happens in a swarm way, and I'll come back to that in a moment. I just want to call attention to the sad contrast between how Toyota works with suppliers and Detroit works with suppliers. In Detroit, everything is negotiated on price, Toyota on cost. In Detroit, everything is done in terms of top-down, total design, where every supplier must provide specs, parts to exact specs. And if a supplier has any idea on his or her own, there is no way that that supplier is going to tell one of the three major automobile producers inside Detroit, because what happens is, in the search for the lowest price, the reasoning behind purchasing agents there are saying, well, look, you must have spent some money figuring out that idea, so I'm going to take your idea and shop it around to other suppliers and see if they can actually find a way to do this cheaper than you, because you already had to amortize the cost of that idea. So what you really have is now a top-down design scheme in Detroit, and you have a very interesting kind of modulated system happening in the Toyota, kind of percolating up with productive friction at all the action points you can imagine. The second example, the favorite example of mine, I don't know if John Patrick was here, but a couple of us are fanatic motorcyclists, and this picture comes to us from Cambodia. Thank you, Buzz. This is done by his daughter after a talk I'd given a little while ago. I want to kind of look at the motorcycle industry in China, because there's another ecosystem developing here in a city called Chongqing, which basically no one in this room probably has really heard of. This is an ecosystem that came into existence in the kind of way I'm going to talk about it in 1997. What happened was motorcycles there were being produced by state-owned enterprises, done in the classical, typical way of total top-down design. What happened is one of the major assemblers who was working for one of these state-owned enterprises decided on his own to bust out of that system and say, well, look it, I kind of see what you're trying to get built here. This thing you're trying to build actually has four major parts to it. It has a frame, it has an engine, it has a suspension system, and it has fairings. If we can kind of decide on what those actually should look like, then I'm going to organize a vast web of sub-suppliers, second and third tier suppliers, that will be coordinated around this focal object, because basically we are in fact doing a copycat. We're not copying the logo, but we're taking an existing motorcycle and saying, hey, that is an artifact. We want to find a much better way to build and much cheaper way to build it. And what happens now is you have a very interesting swarm innovation cycle developing, starting around the actual tea houses in Chongqing, where suppliers and sub-suppliers start negotiating. And again, you find, just like I was saying in Toyota, but now much more informally, saying, well, you know, if I do the headlight this way, can you compensate for this design and the fairing over this way, and so on and so forth. So you get these swarms of negotiations happening, and up comes basically a brand new motorcycle. Why this is interesting is Honda likewise builds motorcycles in Chongqing. The trouble is this swarm innovation technique, in terms of basically a whole new process for how to do bottom-up innovation, based on a focal design, because everybody knew what the final object was to look like, has led to the ability to build motorcycles that have devastated Honda. Since 1997, Honda's market share in Vietnam, for example, has gone from 90% to 30%. This ecosystem now produces over 50% of all the motorcycles in the world. No one can come close to competing with the cost structure of this. And notice that this has a lot of relationship to do to kind of how open source works, because most open source systems have a reference implementation, which creates an implicit coordination structure for this whole system to work. This is what's happening here too. A focal design is picked, and that becomes the reference implementation to coordinate this swarm of people. Third example is called the ODMs in Taiwan, ODM standing for Original Design Manufacturer. You might not realize it, but almost every product you have today in front of you comes from an ODM. An ODM basically gets contacted by Dell, by Hewlett-Packard, by Kodak, to say, hey, I want a camera of this kind. Here are the kind of properties that I want. Does Kodak or does Hewlett-Packard design and detail that camera? No way. They turn it over to the ODM in Taiwan, and then this ODM likewise has this vast network of innovative suppliers. And that whole network starts to work on figuring out a way to build such a camera at such a price point. In fact, I was shocked. I just came back from one of the biggest ODMs in Taiwan. I was walking through their factory, and I was very surprised, let's say, to see that they were producing the highest-end flat panel TVs for Sony. Even Sony has to use these folks to do this. I happened to be meeting with the guy designing the brand new receiver in and new imaging processing chip inside that TV. Massive amounts of innovation are happening on the fly all through that network. So basically, it's a very major distributed network all through Taiwan that actually does the design, and then basically it gets manufactured in southern China. My last example has to do with what we wear. This comes from Lian Fong. Lian Fong is a 100-plus-year-old trading organization originally out of Hong Kong. And we all know the apparel industry has about a 2% margin. Ironically, Victor Fong, Lian Fong, he turns out to have basically, on the average, a 50% ROE. It has dropped down to 30% several times, and most of the time it runs around 50% ROE. He has a $5 billion revenue. And in Asia, since most of the people are Asians, he's getting $1 million stick-through revenue per person. What is going on in terms of his ability to be a major orchestrator in terms of picking up kind of deep specializations in hundreds of different ecologies, ecosystems around the world? I'm going to look at mostly Asia at the moment, to be able to put together a unique garment at a price point that is almost unmatchable. The example here is after he's negotiated something often with Ann Taylor, Ann Taylor would say, here's what I want. Victor would say, no, I'm not sure you really want that. I know that basically there's a new kind of yarn that's going to become available over here in Thailand. Let me use my yarn, I can weave it this way, I can dye it this way, I can cut it this way, and in fact, you get something that is basically indistinguishable what you want, and I'm going to be able to deliver that to you at a fraction of the cost. So what Victor knows is once he kind of understands the basic idea of what Ann Taylor wants, can take his expertise of dozens of different ecosystems around the world and find exactly, if this is the person who's producing the yarn over here, actually in Taiwan, or in Thailand, basically that yarn produced that way can be better woven over here. If woven over here, it can be better cut by here. And he will move these objects all around the world in terms of using the extreme distinctive expertise of one particular firm in each one of these ecosystems that he taps. If that were all there were to it, it wouldn't be all that interesting. But what's really interesting is he views this meta-ecosystem as a major learning architecture. Not only does he have kind of high quality and performance metrics he puts on all of the transactions he's studying, but what he looks at is how to basically do benchmarking within an ecosystem. So several of his factories, or the factories he deals with within a particular ecosystem, can kind of understand how each other is doing. But more interesting to me is he actually looks at how this supplier inside this ecosystem can learn from this supplier that down the value chain in this ecosystem. And so there's a lot of cross-learning happening that he basically orchestrates. So you might think all he does is orchestrate a supply chain, but in fact, no. He is actually orchestrating learning left, right, and sideways, and he has all kinds of interesting ways to manage these operations. For example, he would never, never take more than about 60% of the goods from any one supplier. Why? Because basically he wants to see what his competitors are doing. He wants to see basically or his competitors, when this particular supplier can't deliver or has to keep changing the competitor supplier, usually is a sign that something else is going on he may not know. Those are three particularly interesting four examples. What I want to suggest is that this whole offshoring has a lot more to do than just wage arbitration. In fact, it has to do with accessing distinctive skills. Let me give you a couple of examples and look a little bit more at the strategic ramifications of this. If you want to do extrusion plastics, which is the way you build most of the consumer goods you know of today, there is no better place in the world than to do it in this ecosystem just north of Hong Kong. In fact, if you want to build a complex systems on a chip inside a cell phone, there is no better place in the world to do it than to tap the ecosystem about 100 miles south of Beijing. So what you really see is there have been very interesting feedback systems inside these ecosystems that are accelerating the distinctive skill formations in these particular ecosystems. Learning is critical. In fact, I want to show one tiny example of a call center called Telecare. This actually comes out of the Philippines that we stumbled into that turns out to be one of the best call centers in the world. What happens here is a different type of management philosophy. This group started out doing the lowest level call centers you can imagine, simply handling stuff to do with stored card values. After that, they moved up the chain. And finally, they're now actually doing serious financial marketing for their clients. What is curious to me is that this whole escalation happened in 18 months. If you go inside a U.S. call center, you find a ratio 50 to 1, 50 employees to one manager. In many of the call centers I've been in, it's 4 to 1. Here, it happens to be 8 to 1. Why? Because these call centers are being run with the belief that the purpose of middle management is to escalate and to accelerate learning on the floor with the employees. In fact, one of the most successful companies in the world right now is called Infosys out of Bangalore. They claim to be doing a huge amount on organizational learning, left, right, and sideways, much more than any of the quality movements we know about. So I was Saturday morning with John, we were interviewing this guy, and finally I was getting tired of hearing the same story over and over again, so I finally stopped the conversation. I said, pardon me, but can you tell me how much time you spend each week with your top management team, your direct reports, on reflecting on what has happened the last week that you could do better? And without batting an eyelash, he said 25% of his time is spent doing that. So they take learning very seriously. What I want to suggest is that if you kind of get this new sense of looking at these distributed networks of suppliers and actually go-to-market chains as well, I won't talk about that here. If you look at this distributed around the world, what we're beginning to realize is that there's an interesting confluence of new IT architectures and tools that come together to really accelerate this kind of formation. The first has to do with service-oriented architectures, that are, of course, the very basis of being able to do loose coupling, so that basically I can use this supplier for this particular job because that particular supplier has the most distinctive skill for the problem I have at hand and couple into that system very readily. But second, if I'm going to use SOA architectures, I have to have an awful lot of compute power. So I have to think about how do I scale out with this architecture. And the new types of virtualization architectures happen to enable us to take these huge clusters of machines and scale out. They really are bringing SOA truly alive. But the most interesting thing that ties into so much of what's being talked about here at this conference is the new types of interaction tools. And we don't talk much about how much you take social software tools, wikis, and even simple things like IM, and think about how do you wrap the social software tools around SOA-type architectures. Why? Because basically, as you try to string this whole system out, the only thing to expect is the unexpected. If you actually look at where our time goes today, it is handling exception conditions. But we do not know how to build SOA architectures or any kind of an ERP architecture that knows, or supply chain architecture, knows how to handle the exceptions. But every exception condition, for example, oh, I can't ship the whole thing, can I do a partial shipment, who pays for the extra freight, is a simple exception condition. Now, you may try to build a rule for that, and if this happens enough, you might see a pattern develop that you would build a rule, but what would it mean is to be able to freeze the context of that exception condition, and the term that Tara will be using called an action point, and then be able to call all the stakeholders together at that particular instance, look at the context of that breakdown, and resolve how to fix that breakdown. So that's kind of bringing the soft with the hard, folding the social software on top of the SOA architectures. So what we see is kind of the fabric underlying how to accelerate this type of collaboration across this vast webs of suppliers. What I want to argue in the last two slides here is there is a new strategic triad coming. On the one hand, if you look at how these ecosystems work and the feedback structures within those ecosystems, you begin to see a new form of dynamic specialization where they become, in fact, increasingly better at a particular kind of distinctive skill. If that's the case, then you want to be able to see how you could string together kind of complementary innovations down the whole value chain. So now you have to look at how do you string across these different ecosystems as well as picking up the distinctive dynamic skill inside the ecosystem. So you got learning this way and you got connections going this way. And if you do those two things right, basically you find a new way to accelerate capability building. So our argument is that the only sustainable edge is figuring out how you can accelerate capability building faster than anybody else. And you can do that, not just by looking at how you do your own learning inside the firm, but how do you actually set up partnerships that are structured for you to learn from them and to enable them to learn also from you. And so it's a kind of a different sense of how do you look at who should you partner with. And under this kind of a framework, perhaps the real purpose of the firm nowadays is not to lower transaction costs, because that's become, again, a commodity, but rather how do you accelerate through productive friction the ability to learn and to innovate. With that, thank you.
We have time for a few questions, if you take them.
Jonathan Marks from Amsterdam. Are you hopeful that any companies in the U.S. and in old Europe will actually adopt any of these techniques?
We sure hope so. You know, I don't have much confidence.
Because otherwise Europe is going to be the sort of Florida of the world, is sort of retirement home for visitors from Asia.
With bad weather.
Yeah. I have very little confidence that Detroit's going to be able to pick this up because it is such a reversal of culture. I mean, it is such a top-down dictation culture rather than a bottom-up type culture. But, of course, companies like Toyota are all over the United States, and if you look at how they're working with their suppliers now, you know, that is turning out to be an interesting learning example after we pass through the denial stage. But I think also, you know, you're seeing more and more. I mean, for example, Dell has figured this out. HP has figured this out to some extent. I mean, you're finding a lot of large-scale companies doing it. But they're doing it without really thinking about what can they learn coming back. So I met some friends of mine in Bangalore from HP Research Labs, and they were saying how they were overlooking at XYZ. And as we were getting on the airplane, I said, well, did you learn anything from this visit? And they were jolted by the question. I said, no, we were down here to tell them how to do it. QED. That may be a little bit, I mean, that is a direct quote, but that is the spirit that we actually have. And if you spend very much time in Bangalore, we have a hell of a lot to learn. And the rate of patents being produced by Wipro, for example, is pretty astounding.
Hi, Chris Noble. From your examples, I'm trying to get a feel for the role that some of the new technologies that we've been talking about and the emerging ones might play in fostering that change. It seems like the chunking motorcycle, for example, I can't see the role of collaborative technology in that if it's happening in tea houses. And so can you just kind of talk to that?
Right. And because this started in 1997, they were using fax machines and actually tea houses to do most of these negotiations in that particular one ecosystem. If you move down to Shanghai, which is the major ecosystem for the automobile, then you start to find much more complex technology being folded in. What is, you know, so encouraging to me, if you listen to what's been talked about Monday and Tuesday here, as you know better than anybody, there's a tremendous amount of lightweight technology that now fits within the types of broadband structures and cell phone structures, et cetera, that we've been talking about here that just fit their problems like a glove. So I think you're going to find that they're going to be much more innovative in using, for example, social software to be able to do this kind of real-time negotiation.
Hi, my name is Jan Hauser. I have brushed up against this area by way of some promotion I was doing for a company called BIOS Group, and they had a thing called a high-dimensional matching engine, which is a mathematical equivalent of sharing lots of information and co-optimizing people in a supply chain. I gave a presentation on this at the Haas School of Business with a big audience, and I got very few questions, just a few. So my question is, and of course, anyone from the cultures you're talking about, co-optimization, they would get it right away.
Right.
So how can we accelerate the process of our cultural change? Do you have any, you know, how are we going to get the guys in Detroit or wherever to, you know, evolve faster?
You know, I think, well, first of all, the answer is going to be slowly, but, you know, as we watch Detroit crumble, there's going to be some lessons to step back after denial and see what's going on. But to directly answer your question, you know, I've just finished working with a major health system in Minnesota and bringing in the essence of what the Toyota system really is, not lean manufacturing, but in fact, how do you do this bottom up? How do you honor, how do you have respect for the ideas coming from the assembly line or the floors in the hospital? And I got to tell you, after we kind of designed the right kind of learning experiences, the CEO and his direct team went through an aha phenomenon. And they said, by God, you know, this could even be fun. And, you know, it is fun. And if, in fact, you've been on the assembly lines that I have in Toyota, you know, those people are working damn hard, but they are creating a sense of identity and meaning for themselves that is pretty damn interesting.
Amy Wohl.
Hi.
Hi, John. I guess the question...
Should I duck?
No, you don't need to duck. The question that I want to ask you is, do you think this works better if we wrap the social tools around the business processes in an informal way, just sort of allowing them to happen, right, or if we built them in a more formal way and sort of, you know, try to put the stuff together so that when you're creating business processes, we try to, you know, formally, you know, integrate the tools with the social tools with the business processes?
I mean, the fundamental intuition, and you know very well where I'm coming from, is that processes basically work for machines. It's work practices that we humans do.
Of course.
And it is basically handling the exception conditions that are workarounds, which is the basis of work practice. And so the question is, can we find a better marriage between handling the exception conditions that usually bring IT systems to a halt and then engage the folks from the work practice groups, the communities of practice, to be able to resolve those where we have, just like Toyota has done, captured the context enough to let those people quickly resolve. And then from those resolutions, see if there's a pattern that starts to emerge. And so that's the kind of approach that we're trying to look at. Been tremendously inspired by how the lines actually work on the Toyota plants around these action points. And how do you bring work practices and standard processes together?
quick one. Gordon Cook of the Cook Report on Internet. I'm fascinated, and can you tell me one or two or X number of good sources, blogs or other places on the net, to plug into, and I'm going to be interested in your book, but aside from the book, how do you plug into the network of people doing this? Who are they? What are the sources? Where do people like myself go to find out more?
You know, I don't have good answers for that. I mean, you know, Phil Evans is here that, you know, thinks very much along the same lines that, that we do from Boston Consulting Group. This is turning things upside down. I mean, I work, I'm on the board, in fact, advisory board of one of the big companies in Detroit, whose name will go unmentioned. And my job there for multiple years was to try to teach them about Toyota. And the interesting issue is that you have an inverted pyramid scheme. I mean, you have the classical American pyramid scheme, but you have in the Toyota scheme kind of a different pyramid scheme where the kings are really the people on the line. And it is a privilege to be sent down as a designer to work on the line to try to fix a problem with the employees. Now, the trouble is you got two pyramids of inverted nature, and you can't superimpose one on the other, which suggests that we have a major cultural transformation. Now, but what is the spirit of this entire conference is saying we're going to do things a much more lightweight way. We're going to build new types of organizational architectures that are going to start to emerge from the types of process networks we've been talking about. So I think we're going to find, you know, small groups finding new ways to work. Now, I might claim that Dell is a beautiful example of that, although I wouldn't want to hold Dell up for how they work with suppliers. But nevertheless, their ability to actually tap the ODMs and how they work with the ODMs is moderately impressive. And that went from almost nothing to, you know, world domination in a surprisingly short period of time. There was an idea there, but I don't think yet they take seriously how much we can learn through dialogue rather than diodes. We come from the world of diodes, not dialogue.
Thank you.
Right.
John Samperi from here nearby. Is it possible, and we obviously would like to see a world where our tools turbocharge this all, but is it possible, or have you seen examples of this emerging, or is it possible that they can continue on Toyota without us with these tools perfectly capably? In other words, you know, where it's kind of a follow-on on the last two questions, where are we actually seeing places where the tools have been effective or will be? And, you know, is it possible
that they
don't need
us? Well, again, Dell couldn't make a move without the ways that they do things. You know, I've been looking at the supply side of this. If you actually look at Cisco, not in terms of the supply chain, which is run quite the old way, I think, but if you look at how they work with their platinum dealers, you're finding there something very close to what we're talking about in terms of, in fact, if you noticed on those social software tools, we talked about e-learning. And what they're doing is they have very sophisticated e-learning tools for their platinum partners so that they become better. But by also kind of using those kind of learnings, you start to talk and see the world in a certain way. It was a very clever idea of how, without controlling, you actually influence. And so the game here is kind of like, how do you use assets that you don't control? If you start from that point of view, which obviously is a way to make your return on assets go sky high, I mean, that's why the ROE of Victor is, I mean, of course it has to be high. He doesn't own those factories, but he influences deeply everything that's going on. But once you start thinking about how do you work from an influencing point of view so that you can leverage assets you don't control, then you have a different mindset, bang, and you start looking at respect. You start looking at why is it a win-win rather than a win-lose. And so that just... Bing, that change of mindset is everything.
Patrick Reardon, hi. Just one quick question. I think we've touched on some of this before offline, but I'm not that optimistic about the big three. I think they're genetically incapable of turning themselves around. I think we all know that, so let's sort of stop the farce. But I think a little more sanguine about U.S. suppliers. You've got guys like Dave Nelson over at Delphi who ran one of those global Japanese production systems who I know you know. What role, if any, practical role, do U.S. suppliers who are a little more enlightened, what role can they play in some of these more loosely coupled global process networks, or is it too late?
No, I don't think it's too late at all. In fact, I mean, you know, let's not kid ourselves. There are thousands of suppliers in the United States right now working for Toyota, for example. You know, I think part of this also is the new kinds of architectures, you know, one of which you built, that actually, you know, will enable a kind of orchestration to happen. Once you think from the point of view of how do you build service grids that help to orchestrate, then you start to build up, in fact, a lot of our book is like, how do you build the trust frameworks? I mean, you know, basically, why should I give you an idea if tomorrow you're going to not use me again? And so what's interesting here is how do you build these process networks, which you have loose coupling on the one hand, but you have long-term relationships on the other hand. So the irony is loose coupling, but relationships, not transactions. And the kinds of, you know, grids, service grids that both you and John and I have written about in the past, you know, actually enable that longer-term point of view to emerge. If, in fact, everything is a transaction, forget it. It's not going to work. So that's the other kind of transition we have to go through.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a presentation from Supernova 2005, held in San Francisco, California, June 20th through 22nd, 2005. Our audio content is delivered by Limelight Networks, the content delivery network for online broadcasts, music, movies, and software downloads, taking the cost and complexity out of internet distribution on the web at www.limelightnetworks.com. IT Conversations is listener-supported, so please contribute to our tip jar. 100% of your donation goes to our team of volunteers who produce these programs for you in their spare time. The series producer for IT Conversations' coverage of Supernova 2005 is Jim Alateris. The website producer for this program was Graham Stewart. Post-production audio by Bruce Sharp. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.